for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering an online master's degree in healthcare administration. Learn the skills necessary to be a leader in the complicated healthcare world. Details at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's not every day that I get to say that I am privileged to speak with a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, but that is my pleasure and honor today to speak with Mark Omasek, who is the author of the bestseller The Big Year and Halfway to Heaven, and has done great work for the Denver Post, and is the author of a really terrific book called The Storm on Our Shores, One Island, Two Soldiers, and the Forgotten Battle of World War II. One might think by now that nearly every compelling story from the Second World War, at least to some extent, has already been told. But we're actually going to be learning about a fascinating moment from the Second World War that I had never heard anything about until I read Mark Omasek's fascinating book. The battle took place actually on one of the Aleutian Islands. And so this was a battle during World War II that occurred essentially on American soil. And it was a hard-fought battle that also brought together two very different gentlemen. And one of the things that Mark Omasek does in his fascinating book is to tell the personal stories of these two men, one a soldier for the Americans, the other a doctor for the Japanese, but someone who had actually lived many years in the United States and received his education here. So somebody, in a sense, with divided or combined loyalties. And their stories in and of themselves are quite compelling, as is the story of this battle on this remote, small, weather-battered island off the course of Alaska. And all of this is told in this beautifully crafted book published by Atria, again titled The Storm on Our Shores, One Island, Two Soldiers, and the Forgotten Battle of World War II. Mark Omasek, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
So when did you get the idea of telling this story? Or maybe another way to ask the question is, how did you first become acquainted with this particular battle from World War II that is so poorly remembered or so little remembered, and the story of the two men whose stories you tell?
Well, my first book was about competitive birding, of all things. It was called The Big Year, and it was about three men who competed to see the most species of birds in North America in a single year. They made it into a movie starring Jack Black and Steve Martin and Owen Wilson. But it turns out that one of the best places to see rare bird species was this place called Attu Island, which is the westernmost island in the Aleutian chain. So far west, they actually curved the international dateline around it to keep North America on the same calendar page. It's farther west than Fiji. And when I was researching the history of the island for the bird book, I learned that the Japanese had actually invaded and conquered it in World War II. It was the first U.S. soil lost since the War of 1812. Now, the Japanese took part of Alaska during World War II. I didn't know about that at all. That was news to me. And so I started researching that battle and learned about a diary, a war diary, that a Japanese surgeon had compiled during that war when he was on the receiving end of a bombardment from the most fearsome military in history, the United States Army. And so he wrote about what it was like to be trying to treat patients, do surgeries, amputations during that. But he also wrote about his family. And that diary did kind of the World War II version of going viral. American soldiers passed it around from one to another, and it was really a moving moment for many soldiers, because this was not at all the propaganda version of what a Japanese soldier was supposed to be about. I mean, Japanese soldiers were supposed to be, you know, ruthless, heartless killing machines, but here was a Japanese man who clearly loved his wife, loved his children, and didn't want to be in the Aleutian Islands any more than the Americans did. And so that was really what got me going on the story, because, you know, it's easy to try to kill an enemy, but it's really hard to try to kill a man.
Hmm. To when one sees one's enemy as a human being, then suddenly war feels very, very different than when one views one's enemy as a monster, as something other than human or less than human. So this was, in a sense,
that's the first time we always do in war, is we dehumanize the enemy. We make the enemy into a symbol. And, you know, maybe that's what politicians or, you know, and not so much generals, but a little bit. But ultimately, you know, wars might be declared by politicians. Wars, the tactics and strategies might be determined by generals, but ultimately it's people. It's me and you and neighbors who fight wars. And more so, it's people who live with the aftermath. And that was also a really moving part that got me going on the story, was that this was a 40-year quest after the battle to seek peace and atonement. The generals might wage war, but it's the soldiers who are left with the PTSD, the post-traumatic stress disorder, or, you know, as it used to be called in those days, shell shock. And it's the families who deal with that. And so this story was a chance for me to tell about a war I'd never heard of in a really amazing place that few people also had heard of. But I got to tell the story of war from both sides and what some of the consequences are to people who are giving and taking shells.
Before we talk about the battle and these two specific men whose stories you chronicle in such illuminating detail, I want to talk just a little further about the diary itself. And I find this actually incredibly fascinating, that this diary, as you said, in a sense, went viral. I mean, it was translated and retranslated and duplicated, mimeographed, whatever, and distributed through, it went into the hands of who knows how many different American soldiers. You say that this diary became quickly a coveted war souvenir, with hundreds of copies of it circulating. Explain why this diary held such fascination, and kind of the means by which it spread so quickly.
Well, listen, the U.S. soldiers had been training to fight in the desert. They had been training in the Mojave Desert of California, thinking that they were going to be fighting Rommel in the desert sands of North Africa. Instead, they get shifted to Alaska. They've got a lot of desert equipment, and they're dropped on a really cold and really miserable place. And they don't know much about the enemy. They don't know who the other guy is. They're just told that he's a bad guy. Go out and kill him. There are 3,000 Japanese soldiers on an island, 350 square miles. Now, this island's about 15 times bigger than Manhattan. But, you know, the U.S. had a fantastic Navy, and they had blockaded the island. So the Japanese had no food. They're running out of food. They're running out of ammo. And 3,000 Japanese soldiers abandoned by their government on the island, and a big U.S. invading force comes to take the island back for the U.S. They were told by their superiors this battle would take 3 days. Instead, it takes nearly 3 weeks, and it ends up with one of the highest, worst casualty rates of the war. I think only Iwo Jima had a worse casualty rate in the Pacific War. And so this diary was such an eye-opener for American troops because they knew their enemy was tough. They knew their enemy was really smart and crafty and strategic. And they knew their enemy wouldn't surrender. But those are all things that, you know, military commanders can tell them. But, you know, what was the enemy actually like? What did he look like? What did he think about? What did he feel? You know, and that diary was the big heart mover, I think, for many U.S. troops. It was passed between each other. One of the real challenges I had with this book was because I ended up counting 10 different versions of the diary. I mean, it's not like you could scan it and do a PDF and email it out to everybody. People were copying the diary by hand, by typewriter. I spent a lot of time in the National Archives in Maryland going through those old mimeograph copies. Remember that kind of purple, really thin onion skin type paper? And each time, you know, the versions of the diary changed a little bit. You know, some phrases were added, some phrases were omitted. And plus, the man who wrote the diary, he was a surgeon from Hiroshima, but educated at a college near San Francisco and went to med school at another school near Los Angeles. He loved America, but as a doctor, he also had really terrible handwriting. And so in some cases, it was a little hard to figure out, especially since the diary was written in Japanese and then translated into English. But sometimes it was kind of hard to figure out what exactly he was writing. Hmm.
We're speaking with Mark Omasek about his newest book called The Storm on Our Shores, One Island, Two Soldiers, and the Forgotten Battle of World War II. Before we talk about the two men whose stories you tell, whose paths crossed, let us talk for a moment about this particular island in the Aleutians, Attu, A-T-T-U, where this battle during World War II took place. Describe a little more about what this island was like, which you call a forbidding outpost in the far western Aleutians of Alaska. Just how forbidding a place was this?
Well, the few natives who lived there, the Aleuts, called it the Cradle of Storms, where weather is born. Attu is volcanic. It's a volcanic island that goes from an elevation of sea level to the mountaintops. The volcanic mountaintops are over 3,000 feet. About 95% of the island is ringed by cliffs, and it has some of the worst weather on Earth. There's only 8 days a year on Attu that are free of rain or snow or sleet or fog. There's snow drifts when they were fighting this war, this battle. Snow drifts over 6 feet, and yet soldiers would step and end up in thigh-deep mud. They'd be stuck. The soils move so much that you couldn't move heavy equipment through there. And Attu is also, because it's at the confluence, the meeting of the colder Bering Sea and the warmer currents from the Pacific, those two weather extremes or differences collide, and they form this spontaneous phenomenon called Willawas. Willawas are these hurricane-force winds, 80 to 100 miles an hour. They come out of nowhere, and there's no warning. And they'll knock you on your butt just walking. We camped on Attu last September, and it was ferocious. I mean, we brought Mount Everest quality tents. I mean, Attu, the closest civilian population to Attu is 500 miles away. There's no cell service. There's no electricity. There's no roads. So if something goes wrong, you're in trouble. And so we set our tents up in the lee of an abandoned Coast Guard building, and it was a good thing that we set them up in the lee, because boy, that night, you know, I'm in my Mountain Hardware Trango, which is, I mean, you see those tents at the base of Everest, and I thought that somehow somebody had landed a jet on the island, because I could hear this roar coming, and it was in the distance, and it turns out that what the roar was not a jet, but a Willawa, and lay in my tent, and it just started, it was collapsing. I mean, it was a ferocious, brutal wind, and then it would be accompanied by these pulses of huge spray. I mean, it was like, you know, 20 people were standing around the tent with those 5-gallon orange buckets from Home Depot and dumping water on you. And that would come every 30 seconds or so. And, you know, my tent is shaking and squeezing, and then you would hear it come again. You could always hear the winds and the rains come from the distance. And, you know, I'm curled up in a pretty good sleeping bag in a pretty good tent in the lee of a building. You think of, you know, 3,000 Japanese men running out of food and running out of ammo, 15,000 American troops being shot at in the heights. And you think about weather like that. Mm. I mean, it is, it's a hard place to live. Mm. It's an even worse place to fight a war.
Right. And you tell us, as you're describing these Willawas, they were the one force that could clear out the dense fog of this place. But then when those 80-mile-per-hour gusts would subside, the fog would creep in. Some days it was so thick a man could stretch out his arms and fail to see his own hands. The wind and fog and cold and rain and snow were so relentless and so brutal, you write, that not a single tree survived on Attu. Just that sentence alone tells us a lot about just how desolate a place this was.
And yet it's really beautiful. The crazy thing is, when you have only 8 days of the year that are free of rain or snow or fog, it's really lush. There's the grass is waist high. We somehow got on Attu Island and enjoyed one afternoon without a cloud. I mean, I've seen all these pictures over the years of Attu, and in a lot of ways, you'd have no idea that this was even a mountainous island, because the fog and the clouds are always there, and they're always so dense. We got amazingly lucky on some of the time that we were there. We saw some of Attu at its worst, but there's no question that we definitely saw it at its best. We had a spectacular day.
Hmm. So explain why the Japanese were interested in attacking and gaining control of the island of Attu. This was it where, in your words, Japan decided to launch its ground war against the United States. It's a complicated situation, and I'm guessing kind of a complicated answer, because Attu in some ways made strategic sense and in other ways did not, really actually served an entirely different function than we might first assume.
Well, you're absolutely right. If you are a general sitting in your office in Tokyo and you pull out a map, you look at Attu and say, hey, this could be a great place to build a base for a forward attack against the United States West Coast. So you can bring supplies in there. You can refuel planes. You know, in some ways, it's a midpoint. But these kinds of thoughts are made by people who have never been there. Because when you are on Attu, not only do you have to fight the enemy, whoever that is, but you've got to fight the elements and some of the worst weather on Earth. And so when the Japanese invaded and captured Attu, which wasn't very hard. There were just a few dozen native unarmed Aleuts living on the island. They were taken as prisoners of war, and that's its own awful story. There were a few survivors after that, but the Japanese ended up on this island, but they couldn't do anything with it. The soils were so, the muskeg was so mushy that when you walk on it, it's like walking on a sponge. And so runways were really difficult to build. You couldn't really build roads for the same reason. And then there was the weather. You just, it's extremely mountainous, sheer cliffs, and taking off and landing when, I mean, soldiers sometimes couldn't even see their own guns. Imagine trying to take off and land planes from someplace like that. And so Japan thought that Attu looked good on a map. The problem is during war, when you make a decision like that, when you seize your enemy's territory, when you do the first ground battle in North America, when you cost the United States its first soil since the War of 1812, then it's not about seizing a small island that nobody's ever heard of. It's about principle. We can't let the other guy get away with this. And so Japan and the United States ended up fighting a battle that had a casualty rate exceeded in the Pacific War only by Iwo Jima. It was a brutal, brutal battle. But they waged this battle over an island that really had no strategic advantage. The only reason anybody was there was because the other guy was there.
Right.
That was a really sad thing.
Yeah. You do tell us that one possible motivation for the Japanese was that by seizing Attu, it could perhaps be, in some respects, kind of a decoy to draw the Americans' attention away from other more significant Japanese operations, such as the Battle of Midway. And you tell us that it actually failed miserably in that respect. But something else I want to ask you about is that when the Japanese actually swept in, took control of Attu, it was actually several weeks before the U.S. government acknowledged this, that this had even happened. Explain why the U.S. War Department was not in any hurry to say anything whatsoever about this island of Attu and about American territory having been invaded by the Japanese.
Well, Attu is a really sad and in some ways shameful chapter in the history of both Japan and the United States. I mean, Japan abandoned its garrison of 3,000 men. They just gave up on them. They let them fend for themselves, and that was futile. They knew it. So that was really horrific. For the United States, I mean, we had just suffered a devastating loss at Pearl Harbor, and the nation doubted itself. How did this happen? Was there a chance even that the United States could lose? And then here comes another sneak attack from the Japanese. Successfully prosecuted, takes U.S. soil. The War Department was in no interest. They had no interest in having Americans doubt ourselves and our fighting men. It was a propaganda loss, and so they just didn't want people to know about it. And ultimately, you know, there were 100,000 men who were stationed in the Aleutians, and when they came back after the war, so many of them described this bizarre feeling of saying, you know, I fought for our country. I served our country in Alaska. And they would just get these dumb looks, these blank looks from people. Really? You were in Alaska? There was a war there? We had no idea. Hmm. Well, the U.S. Had no interest in letting people know that it had lost another battle for a time, and especially that it was on American soil. I mean, so much of war is not only waged between guns, but it's waged between ideas and symbols and propaganda And ATSU at first was a real propaganda loss for the U.S.
Right. And although American forces were able to take back the island, it was not easy. And you tell us that when one really looks at it honestly, it is, in your words, a series of colossal military blunders. And you give us the sense that, that most of those blunders were due to the arrogance of certain American commanders who did not begin to appreciate just how difficult a place this would be in which to wage war.
Well, they underestimated the enemy. They thought that the Japanese, if confronted by an overwhelming force, would just quit. When in fact, the whole Japanese code was death before dishonor. I mean, Japanese troops were never even trained about what they would do if they were captured as a prisoner of war, because they were not supposed to be captured as a prisoner of war. They were supposed to either kill the enemy or kill themselves. And Atsu, ultimately, of 3,000 men, 3,000 Japanese men who started there, there were only 24 or 28 Japanese survivors. These were people generally who were too injured to be able to flee when U.S. troops approached. And the last thing that so many of these soldiers told Americans, the last thing that they wanted to do was to go back home, because it would just be a humiliation for them to have survived the battle. That's just what they didn't want to do. At the same time, the U.S., as you mentioned, was really arrogant. They underestimated the enemy, and they underestimated the logistics, how you wage a war 1,500 miles from Anchorage, very far away from, you know, supply and restock. But they also really underestimated the climate. They had prepared for a three-day battle, and it lasted nearly 3 weeks. They sent men with clothes and supplies for the desert to wage a war in Alaska. And troops, fighting men on the front lines, became so hungry during battle that they were reduced to crawling on their bellies and trying to catch trout with their bare hands in creeks and eating them raw just for survival while they're being shot at. Hmm.
You call this place one of the world's most unforgiving places, and what a terrible place to have to try to engage in battle with the enemy. We're speaking with Mark Omasek about his book, The Storm on Our Shores, One Island, Two Soldiers, and the Forgotten Battle of World War II. The island in question is Attu, and the battle for the Americans to wrest control of it away from the Japanese is that forgotten battle. We have yet to talk about the two soldiers, also mentioned in the book's subtitle. And this is where the story becomes actually quite surprising. So we have a doctor on the side of the Japanese, Paul Nobuo Tatsuguchi, and then a soldier on the American side by the name of Dick Laird. And much of your book is actually a painstaking reconstruction of sorts of their respective lives ahead of this battle on Attu Island. Ahead of us talking about the way in which their paths crossed, how difficult was it to reconstruct these two lives?
Well, in some ways, it was really difficult. I mean, unlike people today who put all their meals on Instagram or Twitter, I mean, the greatest generation, people were really humble. People didn't really talk much about themselves. And so that was, I knew that this story had some really great bones, but the flesh was harder to find. Now, the flip side, the advantage is that although, you know, there was no Facebook documenting what these men thought and did all the time, it was an era when people wrote letters home. It was an era when people kept diaries and journals. So I was able to piece together that. And then, you know, I spent a lot of time with the men's families as well who could tell what happened. And then, you know, the two men were really compelling for all the talk about the battle and about the place and where it happened. The story for me was really about two humans. I mean, a man who was born in Hiroshima but moved to the United States for his schooling, for college and for med school. And Paul Tatsuguchi fell in love with America. He loved the open road. His girlfriend came over from Japan. He proposed to her at Yosemite. They went off on one of the first Greyhound bus tours on their honeymoon and ended up in Niagara Falls. I mean, what more American thing can you do but honeymoon at Niagara Falls? When he returns from their honeymoon, there's a family crisis and he's got to rush back to Japan. And, you know, that's when Pearl Harbor happens. And so he's conscripted against his will to fight against the nation he loves. Now, Paul Tatsuguchi is a Seventh-day Adventist and really a committed pacifist. In the United States, he would have been a conscientious objector. Japan did not believe in conscientious objectors. And so Paul really wrestled with this notion of faith, what his faith compels him to do versus what his nation orders him to do. And ultimately, I think he resolved it in his own head by saying that as a surgeon, his work was healing and not waging war. And yet there's the other man, Dick Laird, who had grown up under really difficult circumstances in Appalachia, moved from coal mine to coal mine, forced to drop out of school at age 14 to help support his family, working underground in coal mines. And he was good at it, but by age 16, he's just 16 years old, he's an explosives expert, underground, blasting coal away. And he'd been hurt a number of times. His friends had been hurt and maimed and killed. And he saw the army as his one ticket out of that really crushing poverty. And so this was a better option. You know, he was a new father. Paul Tatsuguchi was a new father as well. And so they both really had to wrestle with what the duty is to your fellow soldiers in your country, but especially what's your duty to your family. And it was, neither man had ever heard of a place called Attu. Neither man had any interest in being there. And yet Dick Laird became an American war hero. He won a Silver Star for killing Paul Tatsuguchi in war. And when he killed him, he found an address book of the enemy that was full of names from his old classmates in California. And he found this diary that ultimately he sent back and was translated. And it really changed his heart. He came to conclude that he had killed a man who had no business being there. He feared that he had killed another American. And so Dick Laird, after coming home and wrestling with nightmares for such a long time, he spent the next 40 years trying to find the family to seek peace and atonement. And so though the fathers waged war, it was left to their children, their daughters, to figure a way out of it, and whether consciences could be settled.
Right, and to make peace with all of that. When you are telling the story of Paul Tatsuguchi, one thing that came as quite a surprise to me was when you described what you describe as resentment by Americans towards Asians in general and the Japanese in particular, well before the start of the Second World War. I mean, all of us who know anything about this period of American history certainly know about Japanese internment camps and grave suspicions towards anybody even remotely related to the Japanese. But you're not describing that. You are describing feelings and suspicions and resentments that are years ahead of the start of the Second World War. That really came as a surprise to me. Can you just tell us a little bit more about how that kind of resentment sort of would play out, and what was at the heart of it?
Sure. I think a lot of it in the beginning was against the Chinese, who had come to the West Coast in great numbers to help build the Great American Railroads. But, you know, there's the other, the people who are different, the people who look different, you know, the people who might worship differently. And there was great suspicion and resentment against them. Not that there's any modern parallel, yes, the deck was stacked in the U.S. against Asians. There were, you know, while the gates at Ellis Island were wide open for immigrants from Europe, there were specific laws that was banning immigration for people who had different skin color from Asia, from Japan, from Korea, from China. And so, you know, we may have our issues and unresolved resentments against people from a different part of the world today, but it is not unique in American history to single people out because of their race and where they came from.
Interesting. On the other hand, one of the things you describe about this young man's experience living and working and being educated in California was how different it was there versus back in his native Japan. You write, in Japan, so many people had the same background and beliefs. Southern California, by contrast, was a hodgepodge of races, religions, and economic class. It was both frightening and thrilling. And one can well imagine, at least, what that experience would be. And then you write of how young Paul Tataguchi was called back home to his native Japan because of concern for his younger sister. And in this chapter where you talk about him going back to Japan, you describe some of the horrific difficulties that Japan suffered during the 1920s. I wonder if you could just say a quick word about what Japan experienced in these years, but also how, paradoxically, Japan kind of rose out of these ashes of terrible difficulty to become the powerhouse belligerent nation that they were at the outset of World War II. It's a remarkable story of transformation that I think a lot of us in the West don't know.
Japan did not start as a powerhouse country. It was a very poor country, and it had just been racked by one of the worst natural disasters in, frankly, in the history of the planet, the Kanto earthquake. It was brutal. It was an extremely strong earthquake that rocked what's now called Tokyo right at lunchtime, and so all the cooking fires were ablaze, and the earthquake ended up triggering such a vast conflagration that there was a fire tornado. I mean, it was a fire tornado, hundreds of feet high. I mean, it's like something out of a bad superhero movie, except this killed tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. You know, first the earthquake, and then the fire tornadoes, and then of course the cholera and the disease that came after. And yet what happened was, in Japan's response, one advantage of a uniform top-down society is that when in Japan, when they got this goal of rebuilding, they were formidable. They could devote their entire society to a single task of rebuilding. And when that task was completed with great success, they had a great deal of can-do and know-how spirit that I believe then turned to the military. And they started to build a great fighting force in the Pacific and acting really belligerently against their neighbors, against China, Manchuria, against Korea. And in fact, you know, Japan had been at war, a big war, a major war, for a number of years before Pearl Harbor even happened. You know, we talk about World War II, we talk about Pearl Harbor, but the reality is that a big reason for Pearl Harbor was because of the U.S. was cracking the whip on Japan for all of its war actions in Asia. Japan relied on the U.S. for so many of its natural resources, oil in particular, that when the U.S. Announced sanctions as a way to try to get Japan to stop invading its neighbors, that Japan, in their mind, in an island mentality, thought they had no way out but to attack the people who were stopping them. And that's part of where Pearl Harbor came from.
Mm. The other young man whose story you follow is Dick Laird. And you've already touched on the fact that he grew up with a very difficult childhood in the Appalachians, the son of a coal miner, he himself becoming a coal miner. For him, school was an escape until the terrible day when his father insisted that he drop out of school and go to work in the mines. And eventually for him, the military was a ticket out and a ticket to, in a sense, explore the world and find himself. In our closing minutes, tell our listeners about the extraordinary moment when he was able to cross paths with one of the daughters of Paul Tatsuguchi.
Well, Dick Laird had been haunted by his actions on Attu. He was celebrated as a Silver Star winner for killing 8 Japanese men in a single swoop, but his conscience really gnawed at him. And so after this diary, after he'd found this diary, after the Bible had been recovered of Paul Tatsuguchi, the Bible with the handwritten inscription, you know, "Therefore choose life," the verse out of Deuteronomy, Laird wanted to see kind of what was with this. And so he ended up finding the youngest daughter of Paul Tatsuguchi living in Los Angeles. He was nervous. He wanted to have some kind of rapprochement. And so he knocked on her door one day, and the daughter of Paul Tatsuguchi, the girl who hadn't even been born when her father was stationed in Attu, the girl who had been bid a final farewell in her father's diary, she answered the door and saw this elderly man kind of fumbling and going on about his retirement in Arizona and his orchids. And she could tell something was up for him with him, but she just didn't have time with that. She had 5-year-old twins, and so she walked him out. And as Dick Laird, the American war hero, got to his car, he turned and said, "By the way, I'm the one who killed your father." And it was a soul crusher for Laura Tatsuguchi Davis. She had never met her father. She knew him only really through the photos on the family house wall. And so she spent the next 10 years trying to find out not only how her father had died on Attu, but how he had lived in the years before that. And then in a remarkable thing, she could see that Dick Laird was tortured, that his acts doing exactly what he was told to do and what he was very good at, being a fantastic American soldier, she could see that he was tortured in his own mind by that. And so they met and they had lunch. She had lunch with the man who killed her father, and she could see how tortured he was, and she granted him atonement. Mm. And it's just one of the most remarkable things I'd ever seen. You know, we live in such divided times, but here are ordinary people whose nations told them to do something and they followed orders. And they were left with a really terrible aftermath. But they were able to seek peace. And what her mother had told her, what Laura's mother had told her, is that if you become the vessel that holds hate, it consumes you. And so she granted atonement to the man who had killed her father. And she wrote a letter that, you know, it's hard for me to read today because it's so eloquent and moving. She wrote a letter to Dick Laird, and I'm a journalist, and I've seen a bunch of stuff in my career, both great and bad, but this was just the fact, family that meets their father's killer and ultimately becomes friends with him, was really moving to me.
And I'm sure you wish that Dick Laird, who died back in 2005, could have lived long enough to see this powerful, poignant story told so richly in your marvelous book, which, by the way, you dedicate to your own father, John Omasek, who served our country as a U.S. Marine. The book, again, is The Storm on Our Shores, One Island, Two Soldiers, and the Forgotten Battle of World War II, published by Atria Books, the author, Mark Omasek. Mark Omasek, thank you so much for crafting such a marvelous book, and thank you for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. This has been a privilege and honor for me.
Well, thanks. What a wonderful talk. I really, really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
I wanted to finish by reading to you a paragraph from the book's acknowledgments. So Mark Omasek writes, "For readers interested in learning more about the overall war in the Aleutians, the best single source, especially from the perspective of generals and admirals, is Brian Garfield's 1969 book, The Thousand Mile War. I also learned much from the official battle summary, Infantry Operations in the Aleutians, The Battle for Attu, written by Colonel Lamar Took and published in 1990 by the U.S. Army War College. The best account from the view of soldiers on the ground is the 1944 War Department book, The Capture of Attu, which was written partially by Dashiell Hammett. Modern armies had never fought before on any field that was like the Aleutians, Hammett wrote. We could borrow no knowledge from the past. We would have to learn as we went along how to live and fight and win in this land, the least known part of our America." And again, Mark Omasek dedicates his book, The Storm on Our Shores, to his father. He writes this at the end of the acknowledgments. "This book taught me many lessons, but one that really hit home was about the sacrifices of soldiers. My father, John Omasek, served as a U.S. Marine. This book is dedicated to him. The Storm on Our Shores, One Island, Two Soldiers, and the Forgotten Battle of World War II, published by Atria Books. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on the morning show from the archives, an interesting interview with a woman by the name of Jacqueline Novogratz, author of a book called The Blue Sweater, Bridging the Gap Between Rich and Poor in an Interconnected World. Jacqueline Novogratz has gone into the Third World and worked with a number of poor women and helped make possible some very, very exciting new possibilities for them. On Wednesday's morning show, we're going to be taking a walking tour through the spectacular and fascinating new exhibit at the Kenosha Public Museum called From Curiosity to Science. We're hoping to take that walking tour with Executive Director Dan Joyce and with the retired Nancy Matthews, who had a very significant hand in the crafting of this spectacular exhibit. We remind you that The Morning Show is now available to you as a podcast, available through such platforms as Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts. And By subscribing to the podcast, you not only hear the morning show that airs each and every weekday morning, Monday through Friday, but also bonus morning show podcast episodes on Saturday and Sunday, and even those days when we are not broadcasting. So